Afghanistan is known to most Americans as the site of America's longest war. Since 2001, the United States has sent hundreds of thousands of its sons and daughters to fight extremists and hunt down the perpetrators of 9/11. But Afghanistan is more than the war. Today's guest has unique perspective on her country's rich history and insights about its future. She's Ambassador Adela Raz this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to A Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, authors, journalists, artists, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Adela Raz, Afghanistan's ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations. Madam Ambassador, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, we want to talk to you about some of the current issues on the UN agenda, mm-hmm. about the relationship between the United States and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But let's talk a little bit about you, because you have a fascinating story. Obviously, born and raised in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. At what point did you actually come to the United States?
Thank you, Jim, for having me in the show. And if I start with myself, so it was in 2004 I came to the U.S. And I came here because of my, I got a scholarship to Simmons College at the time, and now it's called Simmons University.
In beautiful Boston.
It's beautiful Boston, yeah. Yes. And yeah. I still have my bias to the New England area.
Did, when you came over in 2004, though, what was your experience prior to that in Afghanistan? Like, how were you educated there?
Sure. So I was raised and born in Afghanistan, and I never left the country until 2004 that I came to the U.S. And I was there during the Civil War. I was there during the Taliban regime. And it was during the Taliban time that I couldn't go to school for 5 years. I stayed at home, but I continued to have my education. And that's exactly when I learned English, because at the time, schools usually taught English, but not at the level to be fluent. And I started to take schools and classes at home, and I learned English then.
Wow. You said you couldn't go to school. Was that because you were a girl, a woman?
Yes.
So
yes.
Talk about that. I mean, there were policies that precluded
young
Afghanistan women.
Yes. Look, I always tell people I was raised and born in a family where education really mattered. So, and I was the eldest child. I'm the only daughter, and I have three brothers. And so when I was growing up, I grew in a family where my parents were educated, and especially my father. So for him, always he would tell us, look, education is a wealth that no one can steal it from you. So for us, it was almost so close to religion, and I could pray, miss my prayers, but not my homework. And so for me, I knew my future will highly depend on my education as a woman. But at the time when Taliban came to the in Kabul in Afghanistan, and they said, look, woman cannot go to school, it was heartbreaking. It really was. And
you had been in school before now all of a sudden you can't go.
Suddenly. I remember it was an afternoon that I was supposed to go to school, and my father came from work. And he came earlier because the security situation was not really good. And he came and he told me, he said, you know what, stay in, because outside it's not really secure. And it was just literally the regime change that was happening, because the rumors were going around the town that Taliban are coming today in the town. And we stayed in, and the next morning I woke up, and my dad went to the bakery to bring the bread, and he came and he said, look, Taliban are in town. And he said, okay, you cannot go to school. And I remember, because we didn't have TVs at the time, the TV station was almost gone. And it was the radio. The radio, the first announcement that came in was that for the time being, that was the announcement that it said, for the time being, women are not able to go to school, or they cannot go to school because the schools are not well designed Islamically. And everyone knew this was just an excuse, because according to Islam, women have the right to go to school. And it was according to the interpretation of the Taliban that women could not go to school. So everyone knew this was the statement, and this was the announcement to let everyone know that women cannot go to school. And I couldn't for 5 years. I stayed home, and I remember one thing. At that age, I mean, I was 9 and 10, and growing up in a family where school really matters, so I was heartbroken, and midnight I will wake up because there are specific prayers that we do, and I would do that prayer, just really waiting for a miracle to happen, that the regime change will happen and I would be able to go to school, because most of my friends could go. They went to Pakistan.
So talk a little bit about, including your female friends went to Pakistan to go to school?
Yes, yes. For families who could afford to leave the country.
Okay.
They left to Pakistan, and then they started to go to school. But for my family, and then economically it was hard, and also for my father, he loved the country, and he never wanted to leave the country at all.
Talk a little bit about the experience of living in a regime that is that tightly controlled, where you're saying to half the population, you are less. What's that like for this, an American audience who maybe hasn't experienced that kind of control?
It's tough. It's hard. And especially at that age when you're just trying to figure out the world, and you're just trying to figure out who you are, and you're just trying to build up your confidence. And you're suddenly told by the government, by the regime, that, look, there are certain limitations for you, and these limitations are there because you're a woman. For instance, so when I started to go to homeschools for learning English, and I was still lucky among many other women, because I lived in mainly around middle class area where most educated people lived, and there were homeschools that I could go. So I remember one day I was coming back from one of the homeschools, and I was carrying my English book, and I had this big scarf covering the book. And I saw the Taliban, the vice and virtue group, who were walking around the streets and quote unquote looking for people who were not dressed properly, including women, because women had to wear a burqa. And I saw them, and I still remember I thought they're gonna see me and then will tell me why I'm not wearing a burqa, despite that I was pretty young, but I was a little taller. I mean, this is my height from my 12 years old. So, and I remember I was so afraid, and I tried to repeat whatever verses of Quran I knew, to keep repeating it inside, and just wanted God to protect me. And luckily, probably they saw me and they said, oh, she's pretty young. But when I came home and I told my mom, and I said, look, I need a burqa. And of course, I didn't have a burqa, so my mom borrowed one from my aunt. And that's how it was. So I had to wear a burqa, cover my books, and then dream for a day when I could study. And that's why when I came to the U.S., when I came and I went to Simmons, I did triple majors, and I finished in 3.5 years, and I had an extra credit of one semester. And people would tell me, I'm crazy, why am I studying that hard? For me, because I dreamed of a day that I would be able to study.
So
and
you studied,
I wanted to take full advantage of that.
You studied international relations, political science, and economics.
Yes.
And you also got another master's degree in law and diplomacy from the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
Yes.
When you came to this country to come to university, what was your expectation about what you would do after you graduated?
Correct. Good question. When I came here, I really wanted to go to law school, because back at home, law school is not a graduate school. It's an undergraduate degree. So I came here, and I started to explore the options, and people told me, look, if you want to go to law school, you have to go to take liberal art classes and do a major in liberal arts, and then that will help you, something like political science, that will help you to go to law school. So I started to declare my first major being political science, and then thinking that I will go to law school. And then I realized that for political science, you have to take international relations classes. When I started to take the international relations classes, I realized, well, this major is not complete without international relations. And when I took international relations classes, you have to take economics, a couple of economics, and I realized, well, the whole diplomacy depends on economics. So that's why I did a triple major. But the reason I changed my mind going to law school, I did an internship back at home at the UN at the time, because I really wanted to be a defense lawyer for a woman. That's what my dream was. And I did an internship with the UN at the time, and we had a special reporter the UN has to write a report on violence against women. So I traveled with her in Kabul, in the country, around the country, and we interviewed women in jail and prison. And I realized I was a pretty emotional person. I couldn't really let the cases deal with them professionally. I will take them really personally, because most of those dramatic stories took about 6 months in my personal life to get out of it. So I realized, well, you know what? I won't be a good defense lawyer, because I will always be attached to my clients. So that's how I decided to move towards international development. And I focused a lot on economics, diplomacy, things like that.
So during that period you just described, you were essentially a storyteller or a story listener. Did you write up what you found when you were going around Afghanistan during that period?
Yes, we did. We did. There was a report at the time that came out.
And you wrote it?
I didn't. It was the special reporter of the UN who wrote the report, but I worked with her.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books, including the recently published Kid Number One. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Ambassador Adil Raz, Afghanistan's ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations in New York. You can connect with her on Twitter, too, at Adelaraz.
Then you get a job, you're the first female deputy spokesperson and director of communications for President Hamid Karzai. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big position. And you were still in your 20s?
No, at the time, late 20s.
You're still in your 20s. How did you get that job? I mean, it's a great position, and what an honor. How did you come to the attention of the president?
Good question. So at the time I was working in Washington, because when I graduated Fletcher, and I always say Fletcher trained people to be a global citizen. So I really thought the word very big, and I said, well, I'm just going to be try to help the world globally the way I can do. And then my focus was on international development and working with developing countries. So I worked with one of the international development organizations in Washington, and I covered the Central Asia region, including Afghanistan as well. But it didn't take too long. I started to realize I was so hooked up to my country, and I couldn't let it go. And it was literally just before the 2014 and the whole story of U.S. troops withdrawal. And I realized being in Washington, and I was taught to lobby for not to withdraw from Afghanistan, because it's a country that it's still required at the time support and help. And I realized that I'm acting a little bit of hypocrite in a way that I was staying in Washington in a more safer place, and I was pushing people to stay in the country. So that's when I decided, and I said, you know what, I really wanted to go back. Because everybody thought Afghanistan is a sinking boat, and I said, I wanted to be in the sinking boat to really make sure that the boat doesn't sink. And that's how.
What a nice way to put it.
And that's how I started to look for jobs in the government. But I really didn't think of working in the communication field and working with the president. So I was looking in the Ministry of Finance, the World Bank projects. And then suddenly I came across this request by the president's office at the time that they were looking for a qualified young woman to take the job as the first deputy spokeswoman. And I said, okay, because I was connected with Afghan diaspora in Washington. And I started to reach out to a couple of people and I asked them to put their application. And they did, actually. And somehow they didn't get the job. And then I was asked, why don't I submit my application? And I said, well, let me give it a try. I did give it a try. I got the interview and I got the job.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So you served then under the next president and you started your current position.
Yes.
Just this year,
yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's
so true.
So
that required you to move to New York?
Correct, correct.
And just describe briefly what you do as a permanent ambassador to the United Nations,
sure.
What your job entails, and then we're going to get into specific issues, of
sure.
interest
yeah.
to,
sure.
to you and your,
sure.
your country people.
So I arrived here in New York, I arrived to New York actually, so here is Rhode Island. I arrived to New York in March 1st as the first female permanent representative of Afghanistan to the UN. And despite that, we are among the founding member of the UN. And so I came with my kids and and so my job really entails, I remind my colleagues most of the time and I say, look, most of the missions, the permanent missions at the UN have the luxury to identify their priorities because they just moved on with the natural pace. Afghanistan almost losing 40 years of being a global engaged partner at the UN, we have this catching up with everyone else that are there. So we really don't have that luxury of prioritizing much. Everything at the UN is a priority for us. So really starting with a big task of really making sure we are doing our dues as a global partner and as well as a country that still requires greater attention from the international community. That's how the job is. So the focus of my work right now is in different areas. We do focus a lot on security issues, working very closely with Security Council because UN has a great presence in Afghanistan, a big presence, and their mandate is always renewed by the UN Security Council. And so that takes a big part of my job. Great focus towards women's issues, gender issues, and that of course I'm very biased. It's close to my heart, and it's close to my heart. And also, it's a very critical time for my country because we are on the verge of negotiating with Taliban and a peace deal. And then just historically looking with any peace deal around us, the first compromise is usually made around women's rights, and especially negotiating with conservative groups like Taliban. So my biggest constant fear is that we should not lose what we have gained so far in my country because women in my country have really, really came forward and we have made tremendous progress.
Can you give us a little bit of an update on sort of how the negotiations stand now?
Sure.
My last understanding, we had another guest on earlier this year talking about the current state of negotiations, and at least at some point, I know that the Taliban was refusing to negotiate with the government of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. They would only negotiate mm-hmm. with the Americans. Is that still true?
That's still true.
So how does that leave the Afghan government in the context of?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not only, look, Jimmy, it's not only the government, it's the people of Afghanistan
right.
and how it leaves the people of Afghanistan and how do they feel about the negotiation. I think, I've said this many times, I think there is no doubt in how much the people of Afghanistan wants to have peace in the country because I tell people, look, some may talk about war and conflict and hear about it, but for us, we lived in it. We have lost our relatives, we have lost our family members, we have lost our friends. So we truly know the value of peace, and we do want peace. But the question comes in with what price, and what exactly means in terms of the negotiations and the absence of the government. Because it's a legitimate government, and right. Yes, we might be at the time where people are starting to question about the whole concept of democracy, does it work or not, multilateralism. But look, we are might be among few outliers that it's a nation pro-democracy. We have achieved what we have achieved so far with blood and treasure through the contribution of our allies and friends and support of the international community and people of Afghanistan. Vote in my country is just not simple right that people exercise. Vote in my country means fight for it and lose your life in order to vote. It's just not to walk out from your home and then you go and you vote. People's fingers are cut because they have voted. So this is the way we have tried to achieve the semi-democratic institution and representative democracy that we have. And today, being in a space where the negotiations are happening and the Taliban are constantly denying they will not speak to the government of Afghanistan, it really brings this big question. Why? What are their good reasons? Are they afraid? And of course, they are afraid.
The question, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. If you want to duck this question, I completely understand. But, the United States had security partners mm-hmm. in northern Syria in mm-hmm. the case of the Kurds. Mm-hmm. And to a lot of observers, it would appear mm-hmm. that the Trump administration, President Trump in particular, basically just walked away from mm-hmm. them mm-hmm. And said, you're on your own, mm-hmm. and we're going to protect what we want to protect. But, mm-hmm. If the Turks mm-hmm. are going to come in, the Turks mm-hmm. are going to come in. Mm-hmm. How does that experience, mm-hmm. which is still very fresh, mm-hmm. we're talking about weeks since this happened to when we're talking mm-hmm. today, mm-hmm. how does that shape the way your government views mm-hmm. America's role in these mm-hmm. negotiations with mm-hmm. the Taliban? Does it unsettle you?
Mm-hmm. Look, we are pretty assured of and confident of the mutual interest that exists between the government of Afghanistan and the government of U.S., meaning there is no doubt about the intention of the U.S. government. I think, when I talked about where being among the outliers where multilateralism work is truly because the U.S. absolutely have proven to work for the national interest of my country because we have a shared interest in Afghanistan. So that doubt or that concern doesn't exist. But I think what really is important is the nature of negotiations. I think we do have a shared interest of the U.S. government and my government is the same thing, peace and prosperity in Afghanistan. We want to end the bloodshed in Afghanistan. And I think more than anyone, I think it's the government of Afghanistan, it's the people of Afghanistan realizing the pressure that exists here at the government right now and the U.S. Public, because you have contributed into where we are right now through your tax payment, and it's a very natural question to ask about it. Okay, what is happening to Afghanistan for last 18 years? We're contributing, and then we're still hearing that there is bloodshed, there is still civilians are dying, and there's still conflict. Are we making the wrong investment? And my answer to the American public would be no. You have made the right investment, and I am the result of it. And what really we have to acknowledge is how the story is covered. I always remind people the story is not a balanced story in here, because we only hear about what is not working well, but what we don't hear is what have worked so far well. So I think right now Afghanistan has a legitimate government, has the right government. It's a new country with the younger generation taking the lead and being in the leadership positions. And we value democracy. We value our freedom. We value our partnership. We value our commitment to the international community. That's why what is really important that we must make sure to preserve and protect the gains we have made in that last 18 years. And those are shared gains of us and gains of the U.S. government. So I think there is no doubt in the right intention that exists. But what is really, really important is to understand the cautiousness and the patience that it requires to end the conflict. And we will end the conflict.
You talk about the things that you value. One of the things that you didn't mention is a free press.
Absolutely.
Talk about that.
Yes.
The press is free in Afghanistan.
Yes.
It's not censored,
no.
It's not government
no.
run, and we
no.
could name any number of
Absolutely.
Countries around the planet.
Absolutely.
Talk about why that happened or why that is and how that's important.
Sure, sure. That's another great achievement. And thank you for bringing it in. I mean, not too long ago when I talked about the Taliban time and even before the Taliban time, there was only one TV channel, and that was the national TV. There was one radio, and that was the national radio. So imagine we came from the Soviet era, went to the civil war, and then the Taliban regime. And now it's in the region. I mean, I wanted to be diplomatic and not name countries, but we are among the countries with the most free press. And that is... That's the product in the outcome of last 18 years. And I can say with much confidence it's the most free press compared to any other country in our region. And it's critical, it's independent, and it's very critical. I mean, I will encourage people to just watch the recent presidential interviews that one of our famous TV channels had in Kabul. The way they raised the question, I think it not in many countries people would have the courage to ask a president or nominees or people who are running for election. So this is what the new Afghanistan is. And because predominantly our media is run by the younger generation, and I think that's another acknowledgement we have to make, because the younger generation in Afghanistan is more pro-democratic values, open-minded, connected to the outside world, compared to the younger generation in our region, that their tendency is more towards extremism. Because I always remind people and say, look, for us, for Afghans, for us, war is not a myth. We lived in it, as I said. We know what extremism brings us. So by default, our tendency and interest is to move towards a multilateral world in a country that's well connected. So I think that's where that understanding should exist. And we have to just embrace this new country where women are taking the leadership position. And I also tell people, look, yes, I am the first female ambassador at the UN, but our ambassador in Washington is also a woman. And this is no one would have thought ever before that Afghanistan will be in two very critical positions. Women will represent the country.
We've only got about 30 seconds left. Time goes
sure.
way too fast. But if there's one thing that you would want the American public to know, mm-hmm. what would it be?
I think I would humbly ask them that do not doubt your investment. Do not question what you have done. It didn't bring goods to my country. It did. You have done an amazing job, and that nation, and especially the younger generation, knows the value of it. We're really in a critical time in a way that we are negotiating the peace agreement or the peace deal with the Taliban. But what is really important is that deal must preserve our gains. We should not think that it's a lost case and we are not going to win, so let's go to something as a compromise. We should not make a compromise.
It's a powerful story.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Ambassador Adil Araz, thank you so much for being with us. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.